apologise for the length. That may sound strange, but I apologise for the length of the sheets today, in that it really is more a collection of extracts and pictures of Calvin. But I thought perhaps this was the most helpful way to continue the story of this great man of God. Tonight, I want us to look at the rest of Calvin's life. I don't know, were you all here last week? Well, you, Helen wasn't here. Right, well, last week we looked at the first part of Calvin, from his birth, obviously, to the time that he returned to Geneva in 1541. He'd been there for a couple of years in the late 1530s, but his efforts at reforming the church there, or organizing the church, had met such bitter resistance that in the end he'd been driven out. He'd had 3 years exile in Strasbourg, which at that time was not in France, but in that sort of, just confusion of city-states and church lands and ducal dominions that we roughly know of as Germany. In 1541, things had changed in Geneva. The city was in great turmoil. If I tell you that the two leaders of the party, the sort of political grouping that had got rid of Calvin in 1538, were involved in a street brawl with another party. One of them killed a man, and he was hung the next day. The other man, who was implicated in the murder, tried to jump out of a window to escape and was killed. So, you know, it wasn't just that they'd sort of had second philosophical thoughts. It was, you know, Geneva was a very unstable, a very uproarious city, as probably most European cities were in that time of great confusion. Anyway, from 1541, you know, John Calvin Part Two is a much more stable life in one sense, in that the scene, we hardly need our map, because apart from a few journeys within Switzerland and I think one into France, Calvin hardly moved from Geneva during that time. Certainly his home was in Geneva right through that period. And yet in many ways it was no less exciting and even more uncertain an existence than Calvin had lived up till then. For one thing, we mustn't forget that this map's dated about 1500. By the time of Calvin, the lands of the King of France had encroached closer to Geneva. Geneva was virtually on the border of France. And the lands of the Duke of Savoy were Catholic lands. These lands, the Franche-Comté, were owned by the Holy Roman Emperor, who was a staunch Catholic. Geneva was on the very borders of Catholic nations, and at least one occasion during Calvin's later life, the kings of France and Spain and the Emperor met together and agreed to launch a crusade to wipe out Geneva. In God's providence, they fell out among themselves, and the campaign was never launched. But we know that. The people of Geneva didn't. You know, they lived on a knife edge. It was exciting too, if exciting's the right word, because of the turmoil within Geneva for most of that period from 1541 to 1564. And so before we launch into it, I thought it would be useful just to look at this man, Calvin. Have rather a lengthy portrait of him there on the left by Theodore Beza, who succeeded him as the chief minister of Geneva. Beza obviously was a tremendous admirer of Calvin, and you might want to, if not to discount what he says about Calvin, at least to say, well, maybe there were some blemishes as well. Beza tends to make him sound, you know, nobody was ever more brilliant or more genius or whatever. I'm sure Calvin made mistakes. Calvin seems to have been a bit rather an irritable man. When we read that he suffered from about 24 diseases at the same time, perhaps that's hardly surprising. But I think the interesting features that Beza brings out in that quotation there on the first page One, the man's, you know, almost, well, the word's fanatic or perhaps is unfortunate, but his tremendous zeal. He took little sleep. He worked amazingly hard. You know, he, at one point in his later years, he was ill, and he had to stop his daily lecturing. He was lecturing on the Minor Prophets at the time. He was ill, probably we would think of tuberculosis, and so he was bedridden. And that meant that he couldn't give the rest of his lectures. But he spent the time revising the Institutes of the Christian Religion and preparing another edition of that, revising his commentary on Isaiah and dictating to his secretary the lectures he would have given on Malachi so that they could go ahead and be published. You know, I mean, that's what the man did when he was bedridden through sickness, never mind when he was healthy. So he was an astonishing worker. Another thing that Beza says, which I think can be borne out, especially if you read Calvin's letters, is what you might call the judgment or the wisdom of the man. At the beginning of that second paragraph, on whatever subject he was consulted, his judgment was so clear and correct that he often seemed to prophesy. Well, you know, Beza's praising the man. But it is true that if you read any of Calvin's writings, but especially his letters in which he's giving advice to a whole range of people from the Queen of England upwards or downwards, whichever way you go from the Queen of England, you know, it is the balance and the wisdom, the judiciousness of his advice that makes Calvin so valuable. Obviously, one must say that was God's great gift to him. You can look at his intellect, but then a lot of people have got great intellect who act exceedingly foolishly. You can look at his experiences, his training as a lawyer, his learning in theology and so on, his experience of life as he wandered through France and you know, Switzerland. But then a lot of other people have had great experience and have continued to be utterly foolish. Calvin had that great gift of discernment, of balance, of wisdom. And the third paragraph, I think, is interesting. If you read that through carefully, you can read between the lines. Although nature had formed him to be serious, yet in the common affairs of life there was no man more pleasant to deal with. In bearing with infirmities he was patient. He never made the weaker brethren blush or terrified them by an intemperate rebuke, yet he never connived or flattered their faults. He was as determined and severe an enemy of adulation, dissimulation, and dishonesty as he was a lover of truth, simplicity, and candor. He was naturally of a sharp temper, and this had been increased by the strenuous life he had led. But the Spirit of the Lord had so taught him to command his anger that no word was heard to proceed from him, unbecoming a good man. Well, again, Calvin wasn't perfect in his words, but can't you get a picture there of a man that probably it wouldn't be very comfortable to be with? You know, so much of our companionship is spent in sort of frivolities or not really saying what we think to each other. Calvin was probably that sort of person. If you said something to him, even, you know, like we do just for something to say, if he disagreed with you, he would say so and sort you out and maybe say it quite bluntly and sharply. But two things I think need to be said there, lest that should sort of, you know, destroy the man in our estimation. One, the most important, was that he was aware of his own failing. And he wrote somewhere towards the end of his life about the sharpness of his temper and asked for the forgiveness of his brethren if he had been irritable and over-sharp with them. And the other point, I think, that we need to bear in mind is that uncomfortable though it may be to be with someone who speaks sharply and clearly their mind, it's a great gift and a great need that we have, someone to speak plainly and clearly to us. What even Beza's description can't give us of the man is a balancing picture of his love to his family, his enjoyment of beauty and art, his sheer friendliness in the way he writes to people. He heard news that his friend Pierre Viré, another French preacher in Switzerland, had died. And soon after, a few hours later, Calvin got news that in fact it was a false report and Viré was alive. And he sat down immediately and wrote a letter and said that, you know, when that news came that Viré wasn't dead after all, he had, I forget just the words he used, but such an outburst of joy that he couldn't contain himself. And he just had to write to say how delighted he was that his friend was still alive, and say how he couldn't have borne a night. He couldn't have endured a night of the sorrow. You know, he dreaded to thought what the night would have been like had he spent a night thinking that his friend Viré was dead. Well, Calvin was no cold, hard, ruthless man. He was clear. He was straightforward. He was blunt. But he was also, I think, in most ways, an extremely balanced sort of person. Well, it was this man who faced Geneva from 1541 onwards. Remember that, I think we said this last week, he had been expelled from Geneva in 1538 because the Genevans were not prepared to accept the way that Calvin wanted the church to be run, or Calvin suggested the church be run. In particular, they weren't prepared to let the church discipline the Lord's Supper. Calvin claimed for the church the right for the consistory, or the session, if you like, to decide who could and who could not come to the Lord's table. If somebody had committed a blatant sin, then the session had the right, said Calvin, to bar them from the table. And it was really that issue denied by the town council. There were two councils in Geneva, but we needn't go into the details of those. One sort of a smaller council and a larger council. Together they divided the powers of the town council. But they weren't prepared to grant that. They claimed the right to excommunicate people. And it was over that Calvin was expelled. When he came back in 1541, he had developed his views in some respects on church government and church order, but in the main he put forward these ecclesiastical ordinances about which were then passed by the state, by the town council in Geneva. They were approved by them. These were the rules by which the Church of Geneva was to be run. Now, I just put one or two extracts down there at the bottom of the first page. You have Calvin lays out there that there were four sorts of church officers. There were pastors or preachers. There were doctors or teachers. There were elders. And there were deacons. You see there the first bit, the examination of pastors. And you'll see there in the emphasis what's looked for when you're appointing a pastor. You see there the basic emphasis of Calvin's idea of the church. First thing is to find out if the candidate has a good and sound knowledge of the Bible. And secondly comes his suitability for expounding this to the people for their edification. The two things are both vital. Not only that he know the doctrine, but that he be able to preach it. Because Calvin was a great example himself of good applied preaching, as we'll see. He must be asked, you know, we must check that he holds the teaching approved by the church, and we must find out if he is a good teacher. And if he individually, that's I think the meaning of the word privately, sets forth the teaching of our Lord. He must also be a man of good principles without any known faults. It's interesting, too, to look at what Calvin says about the elders. Calvin is rightly held to be the sort of father of Presbyterianism. I don't know if you're aware that one of the still unresolved debates within Presbyterianism concerns the nature of what we tend to call elders, perhaps what more strictly would be called ruling elders. That is, men who are not ordained to preach the word, who are not ministers, but who do sit with the ministers on the Kirk session, ruling the congregation. it was Calvin who really introduced these elders into the life of the church. And what you have there is what they were to do. They were required to supervise every person's conduct, warning backsliders and those of disorderly life. Where necessary, they should report to the session, the company of pastors, who will arrange for fraternal correction. Now, as our church is now arranged, says Calvin, it would be most suitable to have two elected from the small council and the other councils that rule Geneva. They should be men of good repute and conduct. They should be chosen from each quarter of the city so that they can keep an eye on the whole of it. Calvin didn't have popular election for elders, although the very way he says it there, says, well, in the circumstances in Geneva, the best way to do it is for the town council to appoint their to appoint these men who were to be elders in the church. But look at top of page 2, the machinery for choosing them. These people were to be nominated, and if chosen, they were chosen by the largest council, a council of 200 people. Then they were appointed by the ministers. But they were re-elected each year. At the end of the year, after the elections to the town council, they should present themselves to the government so that a decision could be made whether they should be reappointed or not. Some Presbyterian churches, many Presbyterian churches, still have what are sometimes called term elders. Usually it's for more than 1 year, perhaps for 3 years. And after every 3 years, the elders have to stand for re-election. I'm sure if we suggested that today in our churches, people would look upon it as a terrible worldly innovation. In fact, it was what they had in Geneva. And it's a very interesting, it leads into all sorts of debates about the nature of office and gifts and so on. It leads to terrible questions like whether ministers should be re-elected as well. But that just shows how dangerous these things can be. But anyway, Calvin, in setting out this order for the way the offices in Geneva were to be set up, there were deacons who had a special job of caring for the town's hospital as well as caring for the sick and the needy. Calvin was laying the pattern that was followed by Knox in Scotland and the Dutch in Holland and the French churches elsewhere. Here was really the first model of Presbyterianism that was being laid down. Now, often people speak as if Calvin ruled Geneva like a pope or worse than a pope. It's not true. The laws that governed the town, laws that included detailed requirements on dress and morality and so on, they were made by the town council. Calvin was not a member of the council. Sometimes he was called in and his advice was sought. Sometimes when his advice was given, it was rejected. Sometimes he wasn't consulted at all. You have two instances there, halfway down the second page. By the way, these are pictures of dress in the time of Calvin at Geneva, I found somewhere, but for your delectation. The first one shows the council, this is the town council meeting. A request was received from the drama players to play the Acts of the Apostles. There was a play based on the Acts of the Apostles for the people. It was decided that the text should be handed on to Monsieur Calvin to decide whether it was wholesome and for the public's benefit. And then 3 weeks later, Mr. Calvin, on behalf of the pastors, reported on the drama of the Acts of the Apostles, saying that the pastors found it to be wholesome and godly. But for numerous reasons, it seemed to them best to prevent confusion and disorder that Monsieur Abel, a pastor, should follow the play's production and be permitted to attend it. So that I think, is in fact what the council agreed to do. That's interesting various ways, I think, as a quotation. Again, that Calvin didn't ban theatre and plays, even religious plays, in Geneva. He gave his advice to the council, and the advice was that a minister should be there to check. It may be there were those, I think in fact, if I recall what happened afterwards, there were those in Geneva who would have taken an extreme view and banned theatres altogether. And I think it was partly for that reason that Calvin suggested that if there was a minister present and so on, then if people stood up and said this terrible thing shouldn't be allowed, the authorities could say, well, look, a responsible minister of the church has seen it all and he's approved of it. But there you see Calvin's influence, also I think Calvin's moderation. A case where Calvin wasn't consulted and that caused a lot of trouble was when the council, I think this extract below there, there's a little note by the author, and then in the larger print under festivals, I think it's from Beza's Life of Calvin. The Genevan Council decided in its wisdom that Christmas should be celebrated not on December the 25th, but on the first Sunday after that, and that there should be no other feast days except the Lord's Day. This gave offence to a very large number of people. A rumour went round that even the Lord's Day would be abolished by Calvin. Calvin had, in fact, was not consulted, and he was not in favour of that. Calvin was happy for the church to celebrate Christmas and Easter and the other great festivals of the Christian year. But not everything that happened in Geneva was done by Calvin. In some things, even within the church, he didn't get his way. As is well known, Calvin wanted the Lord's Supper to be celebrated every week. But in fact, the council or the ordinances, as they were passed by the council, only allowed the Lord's Supper to be celebrated four times a year. Calvin said he didn't agree with that, but he accepted it and went along with it. Down the bottom of the page, you'll see some extracts from rules that were made, probably here by the town council ultimately, although obviously in consultation with the consistory, the company of pastors. Geneva, while it was a very small territory, did have some little outlying villages. And like all outlying villages, they tended to be more conservative and therefore in those days more Roman Catholic than the town. And the Council of Geneva had great trouble keeping the villages in sympathy with the town and keeping them under control. And here they've appointed a committee to go round. This gives you some idea of the sort of rules that were made. Now, be clear, these are rules made by the town council, by the, if you like, by the civil government. But you'll see that they cover moral effects and so on. And the church is involved in these things, feuds, you know, if there be any feuds or hatreds among individuals. The minister shall call in his church wardens, that perhaps as sort of elders, and attempt to pacify them. If he does not succeed, the party should be sent before the consistory. Betting, no one should play depraving games. Fine, 5 souls, confiscation of the winnings. Then you'll see there's rules there for the punishment of sexual offences. I'm not sure how much a soul's was, but interesting on the adultery one, that will lead to imprisonment for 9 days and a fine appropriate to this more serious offence to be imposed by the magistrates. There's the civil court imposing fines, of course, and imprisonment. The church court couldn't do that. And it's interesting, too, there to see that Calvin did not impose Old Testament law on Geneva. People often speak as if Calvinism was Old Testament religion, rigorous and ruthless, you know, stoning people for gathering sticks on a Sunday. Well, there's a clear instance. The punishment for adultery in the Old Testament, of course, was death. And in England, various times, you know, adultery in theory was punishable by death. But there in Calvin's Geneva, there was punishment, and there was perhaps a serious fine, but there was not the death penalty. Calvin did not impose, and none of the Calvinistic societies that took their lead from him in Europe and in America, none of them imposed the Old Testament law as the rule of conduct in church or state today. Well, it's obvious from those things that church and state, if you like, were very closely involved. That, of course, can lead to problems. We'll see a little bit more of that later on. But that was the way it was. Perhaps it was inevitable in a small town like Geneva. I was reading today of the colony of South Carolina. It was established in the 17th century in North America, a small isolated colony, under attack from the Spaniards and the French and the English, and the English probably was later on, and the Indians. And but for the first 150 years of South Carolina's existence, there was only one court, and that court was the civil government, the administrator of justice, and the ruler of the church. It was a small community, I suppose, if you look around. Well, there's only a few leading and able men, especially in those days when it tended to be aristocrats who were expected to take leading positions. And it was almost inevitable in a small community that church and state should often be administered by the same people. But, of course, it presents problems. There were plenty of problems in Geneva, coming on to page 3 there. Calvin's Reformation met fierce opposition. Some of that opposition, of course, came from people who hankered after the old Roman Catholic ways and wanted to go right back to that. Some came from people who rejected both Catholicism and Protestantism. They were really atheists, although they wouldn't have called themselves by that word in those days. But there were people around. And there were those who, while they were prepared to accept Protestant doctrine, were not prepared to accept Calvin's church discipline, this organized church life with discipline and excommunication. And it was especially that claim of the right of the pastors to, and the elders, of course, meeting together, not the pastors on their own, but the pastors with these elders, to excommunicate people from the Lord's table. It was that became the focus of opposition. You have, first of all, that strange, rather gruesome thing that Beza records at the top of the third page about plague and conspiracy. 1545, there was a plague in the town, and a group of people seemed to have been dabbling in the occult and witchcraft, which was, of course, quite common in medieval Europe. And they actually took, I don't know whether it was excrement from people who had the plague or dirty bandages or whatever, but they made something with it and daubed it all around the town, trying deliberately to spread the plague. Now, that was an attack on Geneva, but you see, in those days when the plague was such a terrible thing and could wipe out whole communities, it was popularly thought that the plague was the judgment of God. And if a city had plague, it must be that that city had done something very wicked. Especially heresy was regarded as something that would, bring the plague of God upon the people, with some, and they would appeal to some of the curses in Deuteronomy. If you depart from this truth, then you will have plagues and boils, and your cattle will die, and so on. And there were many people who said, the plague in Geneva, that's what comes of listening to Calvin's heresy, and this whole, to us, grim and macabre incident was a very real threat to Calvin's position or to the position of the gospel in Geneva. But in the years that followed that, the 10 years following that, really the nub of the struggle was between Calvin and people who are often called libertines. They had a sort of outward religion, but really we just call them worldly, materialistic people. And there were case after case where these people flaunted their rejection, not of Calvin's rules, but of the town council's rules. There were rules about dancing, severely restricting dancing. The wife of this man, Perrin, danced and then defied Calvin when it came to the court case, used the court case to attack Calvin. And there were fierce struggles within the ruling class at Geneva. There we're told how Calvin at one instance came in to the council and brought peace when they were just about to come to blows. But look at that second paragraph halfway down the page on the right. Perrin was restored after being accused and punished. The malice of the wicked rose to such a height that some of them openly used collars cut in the form of a cross. Of course, a deliberate rejection of the ways of the Reformed Church. And while others gave the name of Calvin to their dogs, or playing on the name, changed Calvin to Cain. There were other instances there at the left. Beza sums up what went on and what grew over the years, that Calvin was jostled in the streets. They took some of the planks or the props from the bridge that his colleague was crossing by night. They stirred up a mob at the church when names were refused. There was a rule in Geneva that certain names like Balthazar, which had connotations with magic and false religion, these names were not allowed to be used in baptism, and these people would defiantly try to do that. They did you know, all sorts of things. Calvin says, I think in the last thing, that they would set their dogs on him when he walked down the street, and that provocation, that attack. People fired guns through the windows of his house. This went on for, you know, between 8 and 10 years, more or less fiercely. In the end, though, to cut a long story short, the opposition fell out among themselves and overplayed their hand. Calvin's presence in Geneva, and I suppose Geneva's geographical position, brought lots of religious refugees, especially from France, but also from other parts of Europe, to Switzerland, even from England, when Mary came to the throne in 1553. And these incomers were at first given citizenship and a legal place in Geneva. But of course, nearly all of the incomers supported Calvin very strongly. That's why they'd come to Geneva. And the leaders of the opposition to Calvin turned against these incomers and tried to drive them out, tried to deny them their privileges, and so on. And eventually they planned a sort of coup d'etat, which failed and led to the final execution or exile of the leaders of the opposition. It's one of those stories that's, you know, in a way you need to go into the detail to get the feel of it. But on the other hand, once you get into the detail, it seems so incredibly complicated and long-winded. Calvin, there was another instance of a man who put a document in the pulpit in the church in Geneva, threatening death to the pastors. And he was found out, and other incriminating documents were found in his house, and he was executed by the town council. But it was a fierce time. It was a time when the opposition might at any time have gained the upper hand. And Calvin, remember what we saw last week of him being a studious, very shy person? Here he, having been thrown out once, he's now come back, and yet he had about 14 years of the most bitter opposition and ridicule and hatred wherever he turned. On one occasion, this man Perrin, I think, was the cause of it. Calvin and the pastors had agreed that Perrin's immorality was such that he should not be admitted to the Lord's table. Perrin took the matter to the town council, and the council overruled the church and said that Calvin must administer the Lord's Supper to Perrin. And Calvin stood up and preached in the church the next day with his bags packed. He preached a farewell sermon because he thought it was inevitable that he was going to be expelled again. And he said that, you know, they could cut off his hands, they could burn his hands, but he would never, with these hands, give the Lord's Supper to this man, Perrin. Well, Perrin chickened out, I suppose we'd say, backed down and didn't go to the Lord's Supper. And Calvin stayed on. But it was a knife edge for so long, and yet Calvin won through in the end. Coming on quickly to his teaching and preaching, I want next week to look more at his, you know, great doctrines and so on, but I can just find the piece that I'd written on. Yeah, here we are. I've already mentioned, you know, how hard Calvin worked, but it's difficult to convey that. You know, when he first went back in 1541, he preached twice on Sundays and once on every Monday, Wednesday and Friday. But in the autumn of 1542, some who appreciated his preaching urged him to preach more frequently. And he then preached every day of the week. And while he found that too much after a while, from 1547 onwards, he was preaching twice on a Sunday each week. Every other week, he preached every day of the week. And he lectured in the college. He gave a doctrinal address every day and three biblical lectures every week. He wrote numerous, let's keep to the preaching first. Calvin's sermons were taken down in shorthand by officially appointed scribes or secretaries who were there every day when he preached. His style was to preach through books of the Bible. We call it expository preaching, to take a paragraph or a portion of a chapter and preach through it, simply explaining what the words meant. He preached with just his Hebrew or Greek Bible in front of him, and making clear what the Bible was saying, and then applying it very forcefully to the people before him, whether it was to economic sins, attacking the wealthy merchants of Geneva, who in time of famine were locking up great sacks of corn in their barns because they knew that corn would rise in price, or whether it was individual spiritual concerns and doubts and temptations. Calvin was again the great pattern for the sort of preaching that we still feel is the best sort in our churches today. Sadly, these great manuscripts of Calvin's sermons, written down by the secretaries, they were kept in Geneva, and they covered much of the Bible, sermons on Job and Samuel and Deuteronomy and most of the Bible over the years. In the 18th century, when Geneva was dominated by the philosophy of Rousseau and other men, and there was no interest in Calvin at all, they were sold for pulp or for scrap. They were just cleared out by the library. Some of those books that were sold have been traced and recovered, but sadly it seems that a number of the manuscripts were lost. A good many, though, of his sermons were translated into English and French, and they were given in French, but into English and Dutch and other languages. And some of those have been reprinted in recent years. The Banner of Truth have reprinted Calvin's sermons on Timothy, which is a book about that thick, and his sermons on Deuteronomy, which is a massive book as well, in their original 1580 English editions. Calvin also lectured. He lectured on the books of the Bible. Well, he lectured on the books of the Old Testament in the College of Geneva, again from the Hebrew text. This wasn't so much a sermon as a commentary, explaining what the text meant and discussing, where appropriate, the views of other commentators. These Old Testament lectures were taken down and they became Calvin's commentaries. There are commentaries on most of the Old Testament. He did similar things on the New Testament, but these were dictated to a secretary in his house, and they cover almost the whole New Testament. Calvin's commentaries remain some of the most valuable commentaries on the Bible. Somebody has described Calvin as an endlessly fresh and eye-opening interpreter. You know that there are loads and loads of commentaries published on a book, say, like Romans, but you can read a dozen of them and find that, well, they're obviously all copying each other or discussing the same things and just churning round the same old questions. And it's amazing how barren commentaries can be sometimes. Calvin usually discusses the difficult questions, and amazingly often he has his decision on disputed translations or meanings is the one that would be most likely accepted today. So he's a very accurate student of what the Bible actually says. For instance, Calvin was very slow to see pictures of Christ in obscure details of the Old Testament. Some of the Psalms, even, that other people said, oh, this is a type of Christ. Calvin was slow to do that. He wasn't fanciful in his interpretation of Scripture. If he says, well, if there is a reference to Christ, it'll be clear and we can see it unmistakably in the Bible. He didn't play with the Bible. He was an honest, careful, accurate commentator. He also was a great writer. He wrote a vast number of tracts or books or pamphlets defending the Reformation, explaining his doctrines, books on predestination, books on the Lord's Supper, books dealing with errors, books against the radicals, against the people who taught that the soul sleeps after death. He wrote a library of books, as well as, of course, his great book, The Institutes, which he virtually rewrote two or three times during his life, until its final great edition of 1559. And then, in addition to all that, Calvin was a major letter writer. There are, in English, no less than 4 big volumes of his letters, but these are only a selection from his correspondence. If you see his handwriting down the bottom of the page, you wonder if it was really worthwhile, but there we are. People can read these things. It's amazing. Some people can even read our session clerk's handwriting. I can't. But Calvin's ministry as a letter writer was a major one. And he wrote to the Queen of England. When Elizabeth came to the throne, Calvin wrote her a letter that's respectful, but very plain and to the point, encouraging her to bring the greatest blessing on her kingdom by supporting and advancing the true religion. He wrote to mothers who were worrying about their sons who were away from home studying in Geneva. He wrote to people facing death. He wrote to people who were abandoning their Protestantism. He wrote letter after letter after letter, and they're a fascinating insight to his mind and his personality. In all, Calvin's writings occupy 59 volumes in the library that's known as the Corpus Reformatorum, the works of the reformers, and they are not 59 paperbacks. That's 59 big volumes. It's said that Calvin wrote more things than any man could intelligently read in his lifetime. Skim through them, but to actually study what Calvin wrote would be more than a lifetime's work. So he taught and he preached. His preaching was popular. He used idioms, analogies that were from the everyday speech of the people of Geneva. And of course, in addition to all that, or along with all that, he laid great stress on setting up this college, which became a university in Geneva, a college where there were lectures in theology and in the classics, and where learning developed to embrace the whole range of learning. Some nice rules for the college down there on the left. The pupils must treat one another in a friendly and truly Christian manner. There must be no quarrelling during lessons. Suggests often rules are very revealing, because the very fact that somebody felt the need to make a rule like that suggests that there was the odd punch up while the lecture was going on, the rules there can be given. There was a rule that lectures were to start at 7 in the morning and go through to 9 with no break for breakfast. Students could eat their breakfast as the lecture went on, but the time was precious. Well, the College of Geneva, as the extracts there shows, was a great gathering place for the exiles from all over Europe. Many a preacher studied there who returned to Scotland. John Knox called Geneva the most perfect school of Christ that there had ever been. Most of all, though, as perhaps we'll see a bit more next week, later this week as well, Geneva was the theological college for the French church. There was a great mushrooming of French Protestant churches in the 1550s, and they all looked to Geneva for their pastors and for their preachers. Right. Well, that leads us on perhaps to look at two more things before we finish tonight. That if we're looking at Calvin's life, can't be passed over. The first one is this passionate concern for the French church. Although Calvin had left France as an exile, although he had this ambition of a scholarly life, Calvin had a deep and passionate love for the Church of Christ in his country. And in many ways, it was the French Protestant Church which reflected, certainly in its earlier years, Calvin's views and Calvin's ways, even more than the church in Geneva. As we've seen, in Geneva, the civil authorities sometimes stopped Calvin getting his way. But when persecuted churches or, secret congregations of Huguenots were set up in France, they were free, they weren't doing what the government said anyway, so they were free to organize and order their churches in the way they wanted. And it was Calvin who drafted their confession of faith. It was Calvin who gave them their church order. And it was Calvin who became the sort of father confessor and the great advisor of the French Protestant churches. Calvin sent men the men came to Geneva. There's that lovely phrase, "Send us wood and we will send you back arrows," he wrote to the French church. And Calvin did train many young men in Geneva to go back to France as pastors. Frequently, the men that Calvin trained were arrested and tried, condemned, and executed. And one of the most tragic incidents concerned these five scholars of Lyon, five young men who had all trained at Geneva and left Geneva late in 1552 to go and minister there in Lyon. And where's Lyon? Here, not very far from Geneva, you see, just across on the River Rhone, and an area where Protestantism was gaining in strength, in fact, where Protestantism is still strong. But they were betrayed, they were arrested, and they were condemned. And Calvin wrote to them in prison. He knew that they were to be burnt at the stake. And he writes, there's just a little extract from his letter to them. And I think when we come on to look at Calvin's doctrine of predestination, his belief in the sovereignty of God, you've got to remember that it wasn't some dry academic locked away in a university somewhere deciding on this cold, logical, ruthless doctrine. That was a doctrine developed and believed in by a man who had to write to five young men that he knew well and loved and admired, and knowing that they're going to be burnt at the stake. And his doctrine has to give him something to say to them. "Since it pleases him to make use of you until death itself to uphold his cause, he will give you strength to strive constantly, and he will not allow one drop of your blood to be without its use." There's predestination. There's the sovereignty of God in John Calvin. One of the great tragedies of Calvin's life, if not the greatest tragedy of his life, was that the French church did not follow his advice. Towards the very end of his life, the Protestants in France, goaded and bitterly persecuted by the Catholics, resorted to arms to fight for their liberties. Calvin had warned them against it. Calvin had told them in many places, he says, look, don't have public meetings. though you may be the majority in your district, don't seize the local church. Don't start having open public Protestant churches, because that will only goad the Catholics into more persecution. Calvin, I think, saw there that awful spiral of outrage and counter-outrage. And sadly, the Huguenot church in France did not follow Calvin's advice. And they did forcefully seize churches. They did physically attack or resist and then counter-attack Roman Catholic powers. And the Protestant movement, which had been sweeping through France up till that time, then became a sort of ossified, a fixed minority fighting the majority. Calvin foresaw that, he warned against it, but he was not able to prevent it. Then, of course, there was the case of Servetus that is so often alleged against Calvin. Servetus was a Spaniard who, in fact, had known Calvin as a student in Paris. But he was a man who adopted all sorts of strange views, and not only adopted them, I mean, always people who were awkward or think differently to others, but Servetus was one of those who had to argue them publicly. And in particular, Servetus attacked and denied the doctrine of the Trinity, and he wrote a book denouncing it. Calvin had argued with him when they were students about his errors on this point. When Servetus published this book, it was published in Lyon, I think, or it was published in France somewhere. Calvin, may surprise you, Calvin wrote to the Roman Catholics in Lyon, the authorities in Lyon, urging them to arrest this man and deal with him. He knew that Servetus was living in Lyon under a pseudonym. Servetus escaped from Lyon and, surprisingly, came to Geneva, where he was recognized and where Calvin reported him to the authorities as a dangerous heretic, and he was arrested and tried. And the penalty in Geneva for denial of the doctrine of the Trinity was death. Now, eventually Servetus was condemned, and Geneva, at Calvin's advice, wrote to the other cities of Switzerland, the other Protestant centres, and asked for their advice. And they all advised that Servetus must be put to death. And Servetus was executed. In fact, he was burnt. Calvin, as you'll see from the bottom quote there, argued or pleaded that he should be executed, beheaded, rather than burnt. But he was burnt. Now, it's surprising, really, that in a century when so much blood was shed, that sometimes people talk as if Servetus was the only person who was ever put to death. But his death is used against Calvin. It's used to portray Calvin as a ruthless and cruel person, as bad as the Inquisition, guilty of religious persecution and a vindictive pursuit of a man who dared to disagree with him. Servetus shows how cruel Calvin and Calvinism really are. Now, the facts are the facts that Servetus was denounced by Calvin and he was put to death. But in mitigation, or to understand the situation, you have to recognize that in just about every society in Europe, Servetus would have been put to death at that time, or could have been put to death. In Edinburgh in 1690, a student was executed for denying the doctrine of the Trinity under the government of William and Mary, which was far from being a tyrannical or ruthless government. Every society in Europe would probably have acted in the same way. And then too, we are so used to the idea of toleration of all sorts of views, we have to think ourselves back into a situation where such toleration was unknown. And Calvin's great concern was the preservation of the churches from what he regarded as catastrophic error. He says, look, even with the Roman Catholics, we argue about justification and the Mass and so on, but at least we agree with them on the doctrine of the Trinity and the deity of Christ and so on. If you deny these things, then you're undermining the very foundations of Christianity. They did regard it as a pestilence, as a dreadful error that would destroy men's souls. We perhaps have gone to an opposite extreme in just shrugging off accepting that, well, probably more error is taught and proclaimed than truth, but that's the way it is. Then, too, we ought to notice that Servetus seems to have been extremely provocative. I don't know why he went to Geneva in the first place, when Calvin was known as his severest critic. And it was during the time when all those disputes with Perrin and the Libertines were going on. And Servetus may have come out of spite to try and help them overthrow Calvin. And lastly, it needs to be said, some of the sheets said it's all hardly on the sheet, Geneva under Calvin's influence was slow to execute. Parker in his biography gives the quote, the instance that you have over the page, where another man in the Italian congregation, Italian exiles in Geneva, really didn't believe in the Trinity. He was arrested, he repented. When they examined him, they felt that his repentance was not genuine. He was sentenced to be executed, but the death sentence was commuted, and he made reparation and public penance, and he was let off. But later on, it's obvious the man didn't believe in the Trinity. Later on, he repeated his views in the city of Bern, and he was beheaded there. But it is interesting, I think, that it is relevant that Servetus was the only man who was executed for heresy in Geneva in the days of Calvin. I think it's one of those sad instances where the intermingling of church and state control did lead to tragedy, and did lead to something which was not in accordance with the spirit of Jesus Christ. And we should be thankful that we live in days where we make it a clear part of our testimony that the civil magistrate has no part to play in punishing people for their religious beliefs. The civil magistrate has no role to play in pressurizing people about what they believe. And while the case of Servetus is not as black as it paints Calvin, as it's sometimes used, we can defend Calvin from the way the case is used. We don't defend it to the hilt and say, well, quite right, they should burn people at the stake then today. Now you see, we get so used to our society. In 1870, the editor of a Fleet Street magazine got 6 months for atheism. He wrote an article, published an article in his magazine that espoused atheism, and he got 6 months in Wormwood Scrubs for it. Now, that's the prisons are full enough now anyway, aren't they? If you can get 6 months for atheism today. But, you need to realize how much things have changed in the last 100 years with that. Well, that's a very brief skim of Calvin's life. I won't read you all. That's Calvin's sort of farewell message to the ministers of the church, him looking back on his life. Just look at the last paragraph there. I think, again, it shows something of the spirit of the man. I have had many infirmities which you have been obliged to bear with. I think he means they're not just physical infirmities. He'd certainly been suffering from tuberculosis for the last 6 or so years of his life, but many other diseases as well. I think he's also referring to his bad temper and his irritability and, his sort of sinful weaknesses. What is more, all I have done is worthless. The ungodly will seize on that, but I repeat that all I have done has been worthless, and that I am a miserable creature. But certainly I may say this, that I have meant for the best, that my vices have always displeased me, and that the root of the fear of the Lord has always been in my heart. You may say, he meant well, and I pray that my evil may be forgiven, and that if there was anything good, you may confirm yourselves by it and have it as an example. I think that's the genuine Calvin speaking, and it shows the modesty of the man, the honesty of the man, and the spirit of the man. And yes, I think there's a confusion actually. That's just I've taken from the book, but it'd be hard if he wrote that on the last day of. Well, unless somebody else wrote that down. I couldn't quite work out that last sentence. But I think it probably means it was written on the first day of May, and he died about 3 weeks afterwards. But there he was, one of the great figures of the Christian church. He lived, of course, he died. How old was he? 50-something. 54. But that was quite a good age in those days. Perhaps life expectancy was about 35.